Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark. I'm back with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. This week's guest is going to be a true living story of what the theme of this show is, overcoming adversity and finding their way. We'll get to that in just a minute. And before we get there, I want to remind everybody to go to my website, www.markpattisonnfl. I've got Mount Everest coming up now in a few months. I launch on essentially March 31st. It's now recording this podcast on November 19th. This will probably air just about 3 months before I actually launch. So if you want to follow me up and down the mountain, you can do so with a really cool Garmin app. You can find that again on my Everest blog, which is on my website. I just mentioned you can check that out. As always, I appreciate the love. We are rounding third base in terms of having 100,000 downloads. We've got so many inspirational people like the person I'm going to talk to today. Please go in, give it a ratings and review. It really does help. It helps elevate the visibility over on iTunes. So a little bit of love goes a long way. And I'm very grateful for all you guys that continue to follow the journey and all these amazing stories that I continue to share and listen to and communicate with. And finally, we continue to raise money for a project. I've partnered up with Higher Ground. It's called Amelia's Everest Lochi Challenge. We all know that I'm going to attack Everest, which I just mentioned, but also when I come back down to 26,000 feet, the death zone, I'm going to go back up and try to summit Lochi, the fourth highest mountain in the world, and come down. No NFL player has ever done that, and I'm hoping to become the first, but more importantly, is raise money for this wonderful organization to help people like my daughter, Amelia, who have epilepsy, in this case, many warriors who come through, military people who come through Higher Ground, have cognitive issues and are amputees and things like that. So it's a great cause. It's a great organization. And if you care to donate, go over to, again, my website. You can see the philanthropy tab, and the thermometer keeps on growing. We've raised now over 20 grand. I'm really excited about that. We've also partnered with the NFL, who is going to be making a social justice grant. So totally fired up about that. Okay, let's get on to the podcast. This is an amazing story, and it's a really amazing story about somebody overcoming some extremely difficult challenges in their life. They had every single reason to give up. They didn't. They went forward, have become very successful in life, and now are paying it forward. And that, to me, is really what life is all about. So let me introduce Young Duan. Young, how you doing?
Go well. Hopefully I can make your enthusiasm do more.
Oh man, I'm so jacked up. Again, stories like this, I mean, my sense is, and I'm going to get into the story and how you got there and everything, but there's no question that you see the world with the jar, the cup, whatever analogy you want to see is half full, not half empty. Where did you develop that?
I think in life, it's one of those things where, having gone through some experience I've gone through, you develop a little bit of resiliency, you develop a little bit of perseverance through any sort of obstacle. And when you've had to go through so many obstacles, you don't look at obstacles anymore. It's just another part of life. And in doing so, you always look forward and not try to think about all the obstacles in front of you. Just move forward and try to do better every day. And I think that's hopefully that's what I try to do. And that's hopefully what the book tells people.
Yeah. And something else that you've done really well at is, and we're going to get back to this word later, mm-hmm. So I don't want to spend any time on it right now, but I'll just share this, that I think when people have your kind of mental outlook on life, and you just see the best in people and trying to do the right things. You know, you also have this thing called perspective, which helps you put your situation in perspective to others who maybe aren't as fortunate as you. And some of your life experiences help you have that sort of attitude of gratitude, which goes a long way. It's infectious too when, you know, people hear your story. So let's go back when you're just a little kid. And, you know, the first 3 days you couldn't open your eyes and they didn't know what they were going to do with you. But, you know, give it to us. The backdrop was you grew up in Vietnam under some very difficult circumstances. So take us through it.
So my birthday was actually the day before my mom's doctor had to leave the country. So I was born after the war. So one of the things that happened was that when obviously communism took over, the war ended. Foreigners had to leave, right? And certainly there was the April 30th, which is when you see all the footage about the dumb war, where people climbing buildings and getting on the helicopters and being flown out, and then helicopters being pushed over the decks of these ships that make room for people. That was in April. I was born in October, and that was the last day for my mom's veg doctor to leave. So I was born a little bit premature, probably a month or so earlier than expected. So when that happened, certainly, you know, I didn't have hair, I didn't have fingernails, and my eyes didn't open. And one of the things that my parents alluded to was whether bringing up a child in a post-war environment with a disability was going to be easy or not. And certainly there was talk of doing the unthinkable, even at that time, just because of, you know, my mom's dad or parents were very rich. So, you know, filthy rich in South Vietnam. So the problem with that is that when communism took over, being rich was not necessarily a good thing.
Yep.
Right. So when communism took over, being rich was like, hey, you amassed your wealth because you took advantage of, you know, poor people and stuff like that. So that, you know, so they were in an environment that was probably not very conducive to, raising a child with a disability, with all the scrutiny, with the, certainly with the thought or the populace thinking that they're not the people. Right? And so obviously my eyes opened. So the good news is, I'm still here. And years later, under that backdrop, that's when my parents decided to leave. Right? And they left Vietnam the first time in, when I was 4 or 5.
And tell me where I wasn't clear when I was going through the book where what the intent was. So you get on a boat, and now the intent was to get away from Vietnam. But where were you trying to get to?
So I think the intent was just to get to Thailand. It's either Thailand or a neighboring. Well, there's really nothing around Vietnam except for Thailand, which is the next neighbor. And then if you want to go further south, it's by Indonesia. But I think the intent was to get out or get away from Vietnam, with really no sort of understanding where the road leads after that.
And then let me ask you this, sorry to interrupt, but so mm-hmm. was the idea then to get to the next neighboring country, which is Thailand, mm-hmm. beautiful country, yep. by the way, I've been there,
yep.
and then figure it out. But in terms of Vietnam and the communists taking back over at the time, Were you restricted from trying to escape or leave, or was there a certain path you had to go? But by getting on this boat, you were like skirting around that. Was that the threat?
So absolutely. So being caught leaving was not a good thing. You know, you're like U.S. There's a lot of freedoms to move about. When you're in a tight regime, there's not that much freedom. So the first trip after we left, we actually saw land, wind shifted, we got blown out back up to sea, and we ended up landing back in Vietnam. And I remember my parents were drilling my sister to change her name to a different last name. Because, you know, with our family name, we were sort of known in South Vietnam.
Yeah.
So she's drilling to my sister that she's, you know, this is your last name. It's Tran, it's not long, right? Just drilling into her. They never interviewed me. But certainly, I think, and that was obviously when we landed back in Vietnam.
Okay, so I get that. So you're headed back to Vietnam because of why? Because the wind shifted when you were trying to get to actually Thailand? Is that what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. So when we got out, we saw land. the wind shifted and we got blown back up to sea. Having spent 7 days at sea, we're just trying to hit land again. And unfortunately, the land that we arrived was back in Vietnam. And of course, once we hit land, we didn't know. We walked around for a little bit before we actually found people. And unfortunately, when we found people, we were still in Vietnam.
And how old were you at this time?
4 or 5.
4 or 5 years old. Okay, so Now the reason why you are asking, your parents are asking your sister to change her last name is because of the tight regime that you just mentioned. And because of that tight regime, you didn't want anything punitive to happen to you or your family.
Absolutely.
Okay.
And even with that, there's certainly, you know, we still spent time in jail because, you know, they now obviously knew that we tried to escape, right? So we spent, myself, my mom, my sister, we spent several months in jail. My dad spent a long period of time in jail.
So what's that like as a young kid? You're 4 or 5 years old. Your sister is 3 years older than you, so we'll call her 7 or 8. And you're experiencing this as a young, you know, young lad, just like trying to figure this whole thing out. And now you're in jail. As a 5 year old, what is that like to be in jail?
So jails over in the southern part of Vietnam isn't quite like jails over here. Right? It's just bamboo sticks in the ground, essentially. And during the wet season, sort of, you finding dry land or dry ground in these jails is not exactly easy either. So, you know, it's jail is jail. I think my memory of it, I don't have that many memories of it, but certainly I remember that, you know, it was a difficult time for the family. Obviously, my dad and sister were separated from myself and my mom. And the good news is that we got, you know, my mom, myself, my sister got out relatively early, or, you know, within a month, I think, or a couple months. My dad, I think, spent a little bit longer time there. And my mom used to take trips from, you know, after we made it back to Saigon, my mom would take trips to visit my dad, you know, change, give him cigarettes, and exchange barter for other stuff. So, you know, prison life was not fun. And the thing that always got me was that my parents, even after all that, decided to leave again. And to me, it's always one of those questions: how bad was Vietnam? How bad was the situation that they tried to get out, literally stared death in the face? And then, you know, spent time in jail, spent time, you know, literally having death on that first trip, and then making that same decision again for the whole family to leave. And that to me is probably the, you know, that story is pretty much, I think, tells the story itself of how bad the regime in Vietnam was.
Well, you know, it's a combination of how bad the circumstance was. And then on the other side, again, getting back to your focus, your drive as a family and trickling down to you, you know, you got to have this relentless drive in you to keep showing up and taking those kind of risks, just knowing that you have such a strong conviction that if you can make it, you know, even though there's a lot of uncertainty, you got to believe that, you know, something's better for you on the other side. Okay, so let's go. Now you're going to escape again and walk me through that.
So we left again, and this time was much less eventful trip in that we the only thing that happened was we got pirated multiple times before we actually hit the beach of Thailand. So once we hit the beach of Thailand...
Wait. You said, did I hear you right? You just said you pirates raided your boat?
Yes.
Okay, so what's a pirate like? And I'm picturing, like, right now in the kind of modern day down Somalia where these guys in these little skiffs come, you know, firing out and try to board and take over. And what was that like?
So definitely we were boarded. I certainly don't remember the exact circumstances. The few memories I have of being pirated was I had this shirt on. And my grandparents or my grandmother, they made their fortune off textile. So they had sewn and inlaid in the collar just gold. I was trying to sneak gold everywhere we go. Right? So we have this collar is gold. And I didn't realize it was gold at the time. I just remember the pirates boarded us. And they just somehow during the struggle, my shirt got ripped off. And I remember falling overboard. And when I fell overboard, it just made a whoop noise and just went under, which is to me, probably the only reason I remember it so vividly is because it was just a strange way for a shirt to just go under like that.
Yeah.
And obviously my parents later told me that the color was really cool. And that's why it was heavy and just went straight into the water. But yeah, we were parted a couple times. And even after we landed on the beach of Thailand, pretty much by the time we landed on the beach of Thailand, all I had left were pajamas. Like all the possessions were essentially gone at that point.
Yeah, so you're going from, as you've described, you're going from a situation where your grandparents were very wealthy, which trickled down probably to your parents at some level. Yeah. And now when you decide to escape, what goes into all this too is like, how do you transfer money out? Probably in those days you didn't. And so you're literally living with the shirt on your back, and now your shirt's gone.
And so literally the shirt's gone. Yes.
Yeah. Literally the shirt's gone. So now, okay. So now you're in Thailand, you've made it. It's a big victory, but now you're asking the question, now what? Now, what was the next thing?
So police came, took us to the police station, and they, at the time, because we left, it was only 4 or 5 years after the war. So they didn't even know what to do with us. We slept outside the police station, literally several days, sleeping in the cars at night, waiting for something to happen. And finally, news came out. The good news is that the boat stuck together. Like all the people in the boats were stuck together. We were a mass of homeless people, but at least we all knew each other. And they would give us food. So after that, we went from refugee camp to refugee. They took us to a refugee camp in Thailand and another one. And we went through the refugee system. Before seeking asylum to various countries, and obviously the U.S. as well.
So you are essentially, even though you've made it and that's great, banded together, you're still all homeless. So now you're experiencing that. So as a young kid, you're escaping communism, you're on a boat, there's pirates, you've been in jail, now you're homeless. Now, you're going to all these different refugee camps. It's insane. Yeah. How did you guys ultimately then get to the U.S.?
So my grandparents' sibling, or my mom's siblings, were all uncle studied in the U.S. and eventually became a fairly famous doctor in Virginia. We had another uncle in Belgium, another uncle in France, and my dad's sister, also younger sister, made it to the U.S. as well. So they helped us with the asylum process, and eventually we got granted permission and got into the U.S. So,
how old are you now when you get into the U.S.?
So we didn't get to U.S. till what was six and a half, 82 is when we got here.
Okay. And so now how does your, learning English and American ways and all that kind of stuff, how long a process did that take?
So I was somewhat unique in that I got out of ESL in less than a year. Whereas most people who go through the program takes 3 years. My sister went through 3 years. I always attribute that to watching a lot of Freeze Company, but that's a different story.
So you essentially learned English by watching Freeze Company all the time, and then you accelerated through the English learning American ways of how to go about. Okay, so now where are you in the United States when you, as a family, you all land?
So we flew to the U.S., which is nice. I think the first port was Oakland, and then we flew to Chicago and then the U.S. Right? This is just one-day trip. My uncle lived in Northern Virginia, so we settled with him for several months before moving out as a family unit to a different place. And the thing about that is that, we're living in essentially abject poverty at the time. Right? So my parents were working literally any job they can, bag groceries or there was one time when we were making meat. Like we would go to someone's house and process meat so that they could go sell it at grocery stores. And I remember just tagging along. We didn't have babysitters or anything like that. But yeah, my parents worked odd and end jobs for months, years before they got permanent jobs. And as a family unit, we just grew up in when we first moved out, we moved into a two-bedroom townhouse. Our entire family stayed in one bedroom, and we try to rent out the other bedroom just to make sure we have enough money for rent. So yeah, it's a tough life, but I think we learned a lot from it and we persevered.
That's incredible. And really, when something like that happens, I think you really have to put your ego at the door. and you put your ego out the door because the, you know, you're coming from an affluent situation in your country, you're used to having money, and now you got to basically go back and start at the very beginning. But at least you have that skill set your parents did to grind away and understand that there's a path out. Okay, so now you go through and now life is starting to get a little bit better for you. And, you know, here comes college, here comes school. And it sounded like you're one of these guys that I wish I was like this, where I had to work at my, my schoolwork, and you, it came, you know, studies came very easy for you. And so you could essentially be out doing kind of whatever you want to do, hanging out with these, your buddies, kind of not work that hard to get the best grades.
So I think in high school, it was a little bit more difficult. Yeah, I went to Thomas Jefferson High School for Science, not to pitch Thomas Jefferson, but it's probably one of the best high schools I've ever been to. Actually, I've only been to one. I've seen my sister's high school.
Yeah.
Thomas Jefferson's really good. But during those days, I was no longer the top student. You know, there was a lot of really good students there. And even at the time, we couldn't afford to do anything. So hanging out with friends were, you know, I couldn't really hang out with anyone, just we couldn't afford it. I didn't have a car. I didn't have means to stay after, right? Like that. So I didn't really socially blossom until I got to college, where now I'm in Indiana by myself with studies and some sort of freedom. And at that point, obviously, I was a little more social. Joined a fraternity, was president of multiple clubs, wrote a constitution for another club. So at Rose is really where I took off as, academics was easier for me. Yeah. So I did have time to go, play all the intramural sports, socialize with my friends a lot more. Those were the fun times.
That was more or less my experience in college. I mean, it's just like hanging out with great buddies and intramural and fraternity and girls. And those are just the things that, you're exposed to when you get out of high school. Okay.
I'll mention one thing though, except for Rose, my freshman year at Rose, there was only 8 consortium rooms. So it turns out that I should have read fine print for Rose, but it was an all male school. And the first year was 8 consortium women. It wasn't until my sophomore year, I think it was 100 some odd girls my sophomore year. I always need to read the fine print when applying for college.
So one of the things that you've mentioned several times in your book called Shifting Optics, A Life from Perspective, is that you've been very fortunate over your life to be in the right place at the right time in terms of jobs. So I want to move on from college and things that went on there and move into just opportunities that you've had, which have then led you to where you stand today. You've started some companies, so you're very entrepreneurial. You've invested in companies and you're giving back. What was that first company experience where you were starting to make some money and some good events happened for you that put you in a position to really see opportunities and then, sink your teeth into those and make those companies into something great?
So when I first got to Austin, I was recruited by a guy named Steve Darn. He's hired multiple Rhodes graduates. And I was only going to come down to Austin for 3 months, because I had to get accepted to a PhD program at the Optical Science Center in the University of Arizona. So I came down and I was living with 3 girls and partying a lot down in 6 weeks in Austin. And I decided to, and the company was doing really well. They helped me. I quickly became their principal optics person. So doing very well from a professional standpoint. I was having a lot of fun socially. So I decided to forego my PhD and really stay in Austin. All the while, really living the old metaphor, the old thing of, was it live like a pauper for 5 years and live like a king the rest of your life. So I was saving everything. I wasn't spending much money, even though it went down to 6 weeks. Play, I really wasn't spending much money. I had roommates, so my rent was $300 a month. So it's very little. So I didn't. But the nice thing is, professionally, I really developed some really great engineers. At a cocky little kid with pretty good understanding of the physics and the theory behind it, but I had a lot of good mentors to really ground me and really take my talents and really say, hey, you gotta have the wisdom behind the talents to really make it successful. And so doing that, all that really helped me in later in life when I did start my own company. And then obviously started my first company, I failed, and then the second company did a little bit better. And we were finally able to sell it or liquidate it and then have some funds from that to invest.
Yep. You mentioned you've been down on Sand Hill Road. That's the famous venture capitalist. I've been down there as well, pitching companies. Yeah. And that is an intimidating experience. You got all these very famous venture capital people that literally sit on this road called Sand Hill. Yeah. And you just essentially go from door to door to door. And all these guys are wicked smart and challenge you. Yeah. And it's a grind when you go through that. So it was interesting to see that you'd done that. You now are in a position, you know, in your life where you're happily married, you know, you've got a great woman behind you and she's got a charity. Mm-hmm. But in terms of your kids, you know, you're somebody who went through the ultimate struggle to make it, you know, finding your summit, overcoming adversity and finding your way. Mm-hmm. And you did. And, you know, my kids, by the way, they've had it a lot better than I had it growing up, and I had it great, but it's just a different experience. And so how do you share that kind of wisdom to your kids? You know, it sounds like they've got a pretty good life, and they deserve a good life because you want a good life, right? You're not going to make them go back and, you know, kind of throw them in jail, of course.
I might.
I understand. But, you know, like how do we as people, you know, how do you communicate that as parents, you know, back to our kids and get them to like understand the struggle when there's not really a struggle in there?
Well, that's exactly why I wrote the book in the first place. It's really for my kids. And that's exactly what my wife started the journey, the perspective journey. Both are trying to give my children a perspective on life that I think they may not get from their daily life, right? They're in a gated community. They're never going to struggle as I did. I hope. Who knows what their life needs. And their problems won't necessarily be germane to mine. So one of the things I was hoping for is with the book is I have a lot of subtle teaching points throughout, trying to ground them. This is where you came from, right? You know, your dad was homeless, right? It's not one of those things where things were easy. And I haven't let them read the book yet, and I probably won't let them read the book till they're in their teens mid-teens. But I sort of wrote this book so that to give them perspective or to give them an idea that an understanding of where they came from. And hopefully when they're doing their own struggles or going through their own problems, they're able to look back and say, this is how dad dealt with something. This is how dad, you know, went through it. And these are the problems that dad had to go through to overcome to work today. And hopefully just give them a slightly different perspective on their own struggles. Because I remember when I was going through life as a younger kid, there are plenty of times when the only thing you can focus on is your immediate problems. You know, your struggles, the hardships that are immediate in front of you. And sometimes it's good to take a step back. Just look at the problem slightly differently, look at it from a different perspective. A solution presents itself. And like you said, you know, there's plenty of obstacles, yes, you know, but everyone's got to find their own summit, find their own way to get to their summit.
Yeah, no, I love that. And what I think it's easy to say that, hey, kids, you know, I want you to read this book and I want you to try to get some perspective. And then, you know, kids being kids are selfish and they're thinking about themselves and their friends, and that's all that matters. But I think when you put actions or words into action, that elevates what you're trying to do with this charity that your wife started, Perspective Charity. And just give me a quick little glimpse of what the purpose of that charity does. And then I think it's so awesome that because you've got this momentum going with that charity and by implementing your kids and having them go experience some of this, you know, what other people struggle with, then it gets back to that word perspective. And it's just not words. It's actually seeing this in real life. But tell me a little bit more about what that the Perspective Charity does.
Absolutely. And I certainly don't want to steal her thunder. So the Perspective Charity's goal is to essentially have affluent family or Asian, you know, family from wealthier nations provide scholarships to families in third world nations where they have less. And the goal is for both sides to develop an impact for the world, have a different perspective on life. Right? So obviously for the third world children, they get to have an education. They get to experience a life that they may not otherwise have the opportunity to. And I could probably tell a story behind that, actually, that gives a little more. We had this one child in Vietnam, and this happened this past year, where the second best student in her class, she was definitely on her way to getting the scholarship from Professor Cherry, right? Because of COVID, we weren't able to give out the scholarship in a timely manner, right? We should say. And her parents, from an impoverished sort of region of Vietnam, did not let her take the national test. So in Vietnam, you're supposed to take a national test before you go to next grade. But her parents didn't even let her take the test because they could not afford the education fees. And the education fees is like nothing. It's like buying uniform or books, essentially. There's not, you know, there's not a fee to go into a public school. But you have to have the books and you have to have the uniform. And because of that, she won't be in school next year. And we can't give her a scholarship unless she's in school. So it's one of those things where, you know, the small amount of money, it was like $80 per year for these students, the parents couldn't provide and had to not let her take a test because they didn't want to disappoint her when they couldn't afford school next year. So that you know, that's a heartbreak over there. So I look at it on the other side where I see my kids, right, have all the opportunities in the world, and they don't appreciate sort of the little things that they get. You know, they get toys, they get iPads, they get, and the goal is for the children over here to interact with the children over there, and both of them develop a sense of purpose. Hopefully that my kids can see, well, this, you know, you should appreciate what you have, and not only appreciate what you have the resources to do better, to make an impact that is much more than yourself into your community. And the goal is to both children, both sides, can make an impact for the world. So hopefully, you know, more affluent kids can use their resources wisely and not be so self-centered and materialistic, and use that to make the world slightly better. And the same thing in the third world country, that those kids get an education that they themselves can contribute back to society. So that's the goal and that's the hope. And I know she's just starting out and she's trying to develop all the protocols. There's already been just really heartbreaking stories like the one she's encountered. And we're hoping to, or she's hoping to put in the right protocol to address all these issues that will come up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, what a great life lesson for your own kids. And it's a great life lesson for all kids who get involved in this program. I love it. I love it. So I want to go back to the book, Shifting Optics, A Life in Perspective. It's a great read. It's a fun read too. Where can people find your book?
Amazon is probably the easiest way to get to my book.
Okay, that's great. And I will promote this on the show notes, of course. And again, it's been really amazing talking to you. And you know, I just love talking and hearing success stories, and you know, the people who had to work their way up and overcome things, and really are trying to do things, you know, for the betterment of mankind. You know, it's just what life should be about, and everybody should be involved. So thank you for your service, and thank you for doing all that you do, and for overcoming those things and being, you know, part of why this world actually works and bringing positivity to everybody.
Yeah. Well, hopefully everybody, if nothing else, reading my book, hopefully get some jokes in there, see a little bit of my personality. But most importantly, if you get nothing, just hopefully just go out and do something. Just more for for yourself, right? Just do something for others. Do something that's you know, good for the world. Not, you don't have to solve a big problem or something like that. Just be kind to your neighbor. Be doing something that's more outside your norm, that does something good for people around you.
Love that. Love that. All right, there he is, Young Duong. Thank you so much for being on the show. Good luck with the book and carry on. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
All right, buddy.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after.
Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.